Well, we'll get started. So just want to thank you, everyone, for coming to Better Recovery Through Neuroscience. Robert's going to be talking, going through it. We're going to be a little bit stretched for time, so I'll go quickly through his background. Robert has spent 15 years as a chief legal officer and policy developer for an American statutory compensation authority. As a consultant, Rob has assisted 8 government entities in reviewing and revising their workers' compensation systems. These projects have resulted in significant premium reductions, coupled with improvements in the care given to injured workers. Robert is the editor of a peer-reviewed international journal focused on workers' compensation topics. In Australia, Robert has organised and run a unique series of compensation scheme stakeholder engagement sessions, resulting in a national report published by Deakin University. Rob has also worked as a consultant for various clients, including Comcare. His current project involves assisting in the scoping and implementation of a comprehensive revision of Comcare's claim management program. Rob's current focus has been on understanding the factors that allow some people to recover from physical and psychological injury as expected, while others do not. Can you please all welcome Robert and thank him for giving this presentation?
Thank you very much, Tony. Look, I've spent about 25 years in a variety of roles, most recently working not only with Comcare but with DVA and New South Wales. I'm trying to make their systems respond better to one particular question. This question has probably been the focus of my work over the last 25 years because it is the place where we have the most trouble. It is the place where we sink 80% of our resources on about 20% of our claims. Unfortunately, the research that we've had in workers' compensation hasn't been overly helpful on this. There is no silver bullet out there. If there was, we'd have all discovered it, we'd all have shared it, we'd all be using it. The problem is that systems either work or don't work in response to a variety of circumstances that are largely local in nature, demographics, values, expectations within the community. And people have, I thought I was going to have to argue this point, but it's been made over and over again, this nasty habit of not responding as rational economic people. So if I've had to look elsewhere, outside the workers' compensation research, to try to make some sort of breakthrough in understanding why it is that some people do well and some people do not. And I've had to call on my own experience, partly in recovering from injuries, because I've been injured a couple times quite severely. And I've had to look and learn about how people process information. And once again, I want to suggest to you that this is the place where we can make the most difference in our economic outcomes. These cases, largely, that I'm going to be speaking about are the most of the 20% that costs us 80% of our resources and 80% of your personal heartburn. Now, as I stand here, I have to take in and do a lot to function. I'm feeling the ground under my feet. I'm feeling how I'm moving around the stage. I'm holding a microphone with one hand, a clicker with another. I'm studying your faces to try to make sure that I'm engaging with you as an audience. I'm trying to avoid the light up there and the fluttering that I see over there and the hum from that. I'm trying to do all these, and to do that, I have to process them at the same time. Everything that comes in is processed at the same time, because otherwise we can't make distinguishing judgments about how to focus, where to function. And when we lose focus, what do we call it? We call it distraction. And we lose the ability to continue doing what we wanted to do. So it's important to understand in this context that the links between thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations, both internal and sensations from the external world, are links in time. If they come in at the same time, they get linked up. If they don't come in at the same time, they don't get linked up. Causation is a judgment that we add after the fact. It's an important judgment, but it's not a judgment that makes a difference with respect to why people become disabled. Now that brings me quite quickly to the first law of neuroplasticity, which is just a more formal way of saying what I just said. Neurons that fire together wire together. Neurons, brain cells, that are stimulated and bring resources or stimulates to the environment that fire at the same time, link in associated networks. And we call this neural networks, and we have them all the time. The best way to envision this is a spider web. And what do you know about a spider web? It's all linked together, and if you touch one place, the vibrations run through the whole web. It's a really useful image to take away from this. Now, we all have these facilitated neural networks. I reckon that if you look up at these images up here, you're very likely to get an emotional reaction or some sort of memory stimulation from one or another of them. You know, much as you might with a song or a smell that brings up memories of another time and place. All right? We all have those kinds of associations. And in fact, when we practice them, because practice makes perfect, then there's a change in the nature of those connections, those associations. The nerves literally fire faster and more automatically because of physical changes in the connections. There's less conscious thought involved. For those of you who've read Thinking Fast and Slow, this is fast thinking stuff. And there's less opportunity for examination of reactions. For instance, when you've perhaps had the experience of saying something that was intended perfectly innocently and having somebody go off of their head on you, that would be you touching the button, or perhaps more appropriately, touching the facilitated neural network of somebody that includes anger and getting that reaction without understanding why. We learn almost everything this way. We learn how to speak without stopping and thinking about how to form the words, which is why I will never lose this bloody accent, okay? We learn how to play sports or music. And if any of you who've done that have ever dealt with this, you know that when you start, you might be awkward, you might have to stop and think about what's going on, but as you continue, it gets more automatic, there's less conscious thought involved, it becomes fast-thinking stuff, and you're able to function much better. And perhaps nowhere is that more evident than when we drive a car. Not only do you have the common experience of starting out driving with one place and ending up getting distracted and going to some place you go habitually, but think about the last time you nearly had an accident. If you'd had to stop and think, oh, what shall I do? You would have already wrecked. But you reacted instinctively. Well, not instinctively. You reacted as your facilitated neural networks had trained you to, so that you could avoid in quick time. I'd like to suggest to you also that this is exactly the process by which we learn our roles in life. That is the role of being a worker or the role of being a disabled person. Now, why are these facilitated neural networks, that facilitated here just means practiced, why are they critically important? Well, when things are associated in facilitated neural networks, if you touch one part of the network, you literally stimulate to a greater or lesser degree everything else that's associated with it. That means everything that came in at the same time, whether or not there was any causation involved. So, thoughts can be associated that way, emotions, and even physical sensations. And if you talk to Butler and Mosley, for instance, they will tell you that this is the basis of gateway theory that helps you understand chronic pain. Now, some of you are going to be saying, oh, now, Rob, there are times out there where something is said just once, and yet it becomes embedded in somebody's psyche. How does that work? Well, things are said all the time in our environment. They're said by the claims manager. They're said by the doctor. They're said by the lawyers. And I come from that background, and I know how bad we are at this. And what happens? I might hear from the lawyer, oh, mate, you can't go back to work. It'll ruin your case. And I might tell a friend, I might tell my partner, I might tell some coworkers or colleagues that that's happened, and that's fine. That's a bit of repetition, probably not enough repetition to entrench that as your thought. But what happens when that person who's already anxious, already in pain, already having difficulty sleeping more than likely, what happens when they try to go to sleep? It goes over and over and over at the speed of thought until you have sufficient repetition to entrench those ideas. We call this kind of entrenchment repetition through self-talk, and it both operates in terms of repetition for creation and also as a perceptual filter, so that we start getting a bias on how we interpret the world to see, make sure that it complies with what we're expecting. I thought I was going to have to explain, but Peter in the first plenary did this for me. The first thing that a worker or anybody else experiences when they're injured is a sense of loss of control. When I was lying on the racquetball court with my Achilles tendon completely separated, I had no control. I couldn't get up. My foot wouldn't work. I needed to be helped off. All right? And with that comes very quickly anxiety and oftentimes physical discomfort. Interestingly, physical discomfort is more than just a physical sensation. It's also an emotion, fear of pain, and a thought, anticipation of pain. Because as people become chronic, they anticipate when pain is going to come in their daily cycle. Now, if the person's situation resolves pretty quickly, then this all falls apart and there's no further harm. But oftentimes, if it continues, then the nerves change with repetition, and with that change, they get this wired in kind of thing. Bad enough. Because if you touch one, you touch them all. But now let's look at the experience of the worker commonly. The first thing that often comes up is economic pressure, or a fear of economic pressure in the future. And that causes anxiety, and it causes a sense of loss of control. You notice that there's no line to pain. Well, that's to remind you that it's not causation that we're worried about here, but it's simultaneous presentation. And because this economic pressure occurs at the same time when there's anxiety and pain and a sense of loss of control, it wires equally into the facilitated neural network. Loss of work identity. All right, where do we spend most of our waking hours? Where are most of our social contacts? Where is the source of our comforting day-to-day routine that makes us feel stable? And how do we introduce ourselves to strangers when we first start talking to somebody in a social situation? Our identity as a worker is hugely important in Western society. And when that identity goes away because of loss of work, then all those things are felt as a current loss. And if that lasts for long enough, and we've already heard the statistics repeated several times today, if that lasts for long enough, then that wires into the network as well. Fine. Psychosocial factors. Look, we heard lots of talk this morning in the plenary about flags. All right? And psychosocial factors have been shown to correlate with good and bad outcomes. The difficulty with psychosocial factors is they're kind of hard for us to deal with. If somebody's having problems with their domestic situation, for instance, that's really, really hard for us to intervene in. But what do we know? We know that is a factor, then several things are going on. If loss of work identity is creating a situation that where the family dynamic has changed because the worker is now at home when they didn't used to be, then that creates lots and lots of occasions for strife about things like, for instance, economic pressure or perceived economic pressure. And then because these are all wired together, literally the worker feels the pain. And any of you who have been involved in case management know that there's a strong association between psychosocial outbreaks, situations of crisis in the home and otherwise, and flare-ups of symptoms, and that's why. Specific negative messages. Boy, my brethren are the best We're the real leaders in giving bad messages inadvertently more than and then by own purpose. But doctors do it, and claims managers do it. Claims managers do it inadvertently most of the time, but they really do a number on people. And when those messages get wired in, then they become repeated over and over and over, oftentimes through sleeplessness. What happens when we're sleepless? We're grumpy, we make bad decisions, we focus on a sensation, but more importantly, we have all that time while trying to get to sleep to repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and entrench these ideas. And that wires into the system. After a while, people start having an emotional reaction to that which has happened to them, to their involvement in the system. Anger, grief, frustration, worry, catastrophic thinking. Now, the most recent little one from academia is perceived injustice. Strangely enough, when people have long-term claims, they feel hard done by. Okay, thank you. And when we see those correlations wire in, then all of a sudden, we see the phenomenon that an innocent attempt, for instance, by a claims manager to talk about the loss of work identity and regaining work identity results in an angry outburst directed at it, which is oftentimes not personal at all. It is literally just a matter of the facilitated neural network firing. Finally, there are internal and external environmental messages. The internal ones are the ones that come from our self-concept, what's happened to us as a child, what kind of family we grew up in, what society we grew up in. The external messages, well, they're pretty clear. They teach us to be victims. They teach us to be medicalized. They teach us that one in four of us is probably mentally ill right now. And when all this gets wired in, the sense of loss of control becomes overwhelming. And as Rebecca Nielsen told us earlier, Viktor Frankl has told us that the loss of control is absolutely critical to survival. In the face of overwhelming loss of control, there really only are about three possibilities. And you've seen them all if you've done it in claims management. There's disengagement. Okay? People simply drop out. That's burnout, presenteeism. Okay, among your claim staff, because your claim staffs are subject to this as well. Amongst claimants, this is the person who doesn't interact with the system, but doesn't improve. There is the development of secondary psychological injury. Look at your big four: anxiety, depression, PTSD, and adjustment disorder. They all have their etiology in loss of personal control, or perceived personal control. So those things are very, very reactive. And finally, if the sense of loss of control gets too overwhelming, then the brain does a little trick out of self-preservation. Viktor Frankl told us that an identity is absolutely important to survival. And when you cannot explain what it is that's happening to you any other way, then your brain does the trick of adopting an identity that makes sense of it all. And in our society, that's real, real clear, that the identity that makes sense of all this bad stuff happening is that you're now a disabled person and you now need to be looked after for the rest of your life. Okay, now that's how it all happens, but this is a helpful way of looking at it for a variety of reasons. If you think about it, every correlation study that you've ever seen linking good and bad outcomes fits neatly and cleanly into this conceptual model. If you understand the neuroplasticity of disability, all the correlation studies make sense, and they make sense together. It also makes sense of the things that we know work. It tells you why early intervention is helpful. It tells you why a return to work has a wonderful health outcomes and other kinds of outcomes that are beneficial. And it also tells you the opposite. It tells you why people who are workless have very, very poor prognosis in terms of their physical conditions going into the future. Now, this has some really interesting implications for injury management. First, we need to look at provision of good information. Information is power here. It is the assertion of control. And we know that people get crap information in our system. The Monash study on GP's understanding of back pain is a really interesting example. I see one person there familiar with it, but that was the study that showed that there was an inverse relationship between GP confidence in their ability to treat back pain and their knowledge of current best practice based on evidence. Inverse relationship. The more confident they were, the less likely they were to have good information. We just saw reform in New South Wales, and what was part of the basis of the reform? That the system was too complex so that we needed to let lawyers back into it to explain the system to people. God forbid we should actually make the system less complex instead, but that good information is the anecdote for dragging people to lawyers, because most often people go to lawyers because they don't have any other way of guiding through the system. People also don't understand the health impacts of worklessness. We talk about the beneficial impact of health of going to work, but look, at the same time, there's epidemiological studies out of the UK that say that a year out of work is approximately equivalent in terms of health impacts as smoking 10 packs of cigarettes per day for that entire year. How many of the workers are likely to raise their hand for that? They don't know. The medical profession isn't telling. The lawyers sure as hell aren't telling. And we haven't figured out a way of communicating that properly. We need to create other opportunities for people to regain their personal sense of control, because it's that loss of control which is driving them over the edge. And one of the things that we can do, and there's a big literature on this, is look at the effectiveness of informed participation in healthcare choices. We have a very passive healthcare system here. Doctor says what's going to happen, the patient just does it. But most often there are multiple options for care in a particular situation. And if we give people an informed decision, we may lead them to exactly what it is that the healthcare provider wanted to do in the first instance, especially if it's evidence-based. But they, by having a better sense of participation, will actually have a better outcome in that, because that retention of control creates the opportunity for them to do that with essentially not fighting their sense of being out of control in dealing with the doctor. And selection of rehabilitation goals is really, really interesting. We heard from Rebecca Nielsen when talking about New South Wales Police, that they were looking at negotiated goals for rehabilitation for medically separated police officers. DVA in Australia is doing the same kinds of things right now with their goal attainment scaling pilot. So helping people to look at the goal of rehabilitation gives them a sense of control that actually helps them proceed. And I can only barely touch on this. We, as claims managers, give unintended messages every single every day, and quite difficult messages. When we transfer a file without informing the worker, we give a message. When we don't answer or return phone calls, we give a message. And all those messages are, you're not in control, you're not important, your claim doesn't matter. I could go on for hours about the practical implications of how to train a claims staff to avoid this, but I just don't have the time. More claims and issues. Look, if you take away one thing from this, take away this. In our system, we require people to repeat their story over and over and over again. And we judge them from telling to telling about whether they're utterly consistent in telling those. And we criticize them and doubt them and distrust them if they don't tell it exactly the same way from time to time to time until it becomes a script. And what do we know about scripts? Scripts don't change. So the description of my life story and who I am and how and what's going on with me doesn't change, yet we expect people to recover? It doesn't make sense. Our systems should be set up to say, fine, that's what happened to you. Now let's move on. Let's talk about the future. So we can avoid unnecessary repetition. We can create positive expectations. We can create positive messaging that looks future-oriented, not towards the past. Talk about when, not if. Talk about reframing the positive. Actually use motivational interviewing and open up possibilities for injured workers. Systemic design things. I'm going to talk only very briefly about medical issues and legal issues. There's a whole lot more here, but I just don't have the time to do it. We can design around functional improvement. Look, a diagnosis was intended to be a snapshot in time. It tells you how you are today. I have a broken femur today. 3 weeks from now, I'll have a partially mended broken femur. 6 months from now, I'll have an amended broken femur. My diagnosis is no longer having a broken femur. Effective intervention is defined as being that which changes the diagnosis over time. Yet we talk in terms of accepted conditions and hold people to the same diagnosis, and then we expect them to change. I've had people literally introduce themselves to me by their diagnosis. And you've heard doctors and claims managers refer to that lower back case or that anxiety disorder case. We need to talk about clinical signs as well as symptoms. I mentioned that in the planner. I'm not going to go over it again. We need to communicate realistic expectations about recovery. In the plenary, Deborah talked about the expectations for recovery for common ailments. You got an adjustment order? Good news! Good news! You should be cured in 6 weeks, maybe 12. Okay? But 12 at the outside. Do we communicate that? No. And therefore, we have adjustment disorders, which become some sort of chronic something or other that lasts for a lifetime. And we can address treatment is only intended to comfort. Uniquely in the world, Australia gives unrestricted access to anodyne treatment, treatment that's only intended to comfort and not to change the condition. And what do we know? People who are injured suffer social isolation because they don't have their work identity and they don't have all that social interaction anymore. So what happens? The person that they're seeing now for anodyne treatment, the PT or so, becomes part of their social interaction and becomes the source of social contact that replaces their colleagues in the workplace, and no wonder they get addicted to it. So a few more systemic possibilities. Look, court-like dispute resolution should at this point be regarded as being the least viable alternative. It is beyond reasonable dispute that when a lawyer gets involved in a case, the probability is that the case will go pear-shaped. Okay, I've got a whole separate paper on that that I'd love to discuss at some point. But there are a variety of things that we can do. Creative use of ADR, alternative dispute resolution, and really using it can be incredibly effective. Let me just give you one boutique example. I did a system for the Navajo Nation, the largest indigenous population in the U.S. And they put in, consistent with their value system, a two-level alternative dispute resolution system. As a result of that, they went for the next 14 years, it's a relatively small population, they had about 7,700 claims. They had one, count them, one that went to trial. All the other ones got settled before that. And guess what? They called me back 14 years later to redo their system. Why? They had saved so much money by not having cases go into that kind of dispute that they had an embarrassingly large premium surplus on a 1.25% premium loading, They had an embarrassingly large premium surplus, and they wanted increased benefits in a rational way to spread the wealth back out to the claimants. All right? So that's what you can do with creative ADR. You can use specialized venues. When did we ever think that lawyers and judges, who are former lawyers, were experts in deciding medical disputes? They don't have that training. When did we ever think that they had were experts in causality or experts in understanding how people might recover in the workplace or how they might fit into an accommodation at work? They don't have that expertise. It's a separate qualification. Yet those are the people that we let decide things, and then we wonder why it goes pear-shaped. Look, as I said, New South Wales put in lawyers again to act as guides to the system. One of the things that we can do is look at the criminal law. In the criminal law, we provide public advocates to help criminal defendants provide a proper defense. There are a number of jurisdictions, including one in Australia, that does that with respect to workers' compensation. Why not experiment a bit in our design of schemes with the provision of people who don't have a profit motive to provide that kind of service? And we really, really need to consider the fact that most of our system regulation is set up on the idea that there are 5 to 10% of people out there who are trying to get something over the system, so we regulate the entire system as if they're part of that 5 to 10%. And that communicated distrust gets incorporated as an environmental message that poisons the atmosphere and is returned as distrust of the claimants to us. We really need to address that. Last, I know I'm running very short on time. I want to talk a little bit about the implications for resilience here. Now, you've heard about resilience. Resilience was a term coined by educational academics to explain why it was that some disadvantaged kids who we expected to fall over didn't fall over. Okay? And they did lots of interesting correlation studies to find out why they didn't fall over. And they found that there were a lot of interesting things like having more self-esteem, having a mentor, having an optimistic outlook, which were correlated to success. So we get told, be more optimistic, you'll be more resilient. To me, that's a little bit like saying, if you want to be wealthy, have more money. All right? It's not very helpful. And because it's not helpful, I looked deeper, and it turns out that what we already have in front of us gives us the answer of what resilience is really and how it works. We know that repetition is what causes the facilitation of neural networks, the entrenchment of these ideas and beliefs, the entrenchment of the connections between things. We know that most of the repetition we have is through self-talk. So wouldn't it be more interesting if we talked about resilience as being functionally the ability to moderate, quiet, or change the nature of our self-talk? Now that, as a definition, allows us to do some really, really interesting things. Like, for instance, recognize that there's more than one kind of resilience in the world. The single mom who's working two jobs and studying at night is a really resilient person. You don't look anything like the entrepreneur who's just lost $1 million but isn't the least bit worried because they can make another million. And neither one of those looks a whole lot like, say, the Zen master who really doesn't have any concern about anything that's happening in the day-to-day world because it's all just shadow as far as he or she is concerned. Those people are archetypes of different kinds of resilience. There are really about four archetypes. The other one is the reframer, the person who finds a positive message out of every challenge. And this allows us to understand those four archetypes. And I can tell you right now that I can test with a 22-item profile you to find out what your preferences, what your natural preferences amongst those styles. I'm probably not going to do a lot for you to help you build up your primary style of resilience, but guess what? The skill set that's involved in your second most favorite is one that can be raised, so that you will have more to fall back on if times get tough and your primary resilience skill set gets overwhelmed. So it actually allows for functional training of specific skills to build resilience, not just admonishments to being more optimistic or admonishments to breathe deeply and drink water. No offense to the people who do that. It's the best that they have because they've been stuck looking in one place. You look larger, then you get further. That allows us to consider the reduction of injury, both by making the workplaces safer and by inoculating employees that are at risk. It allows us to consider new interventions to minimize psychological injury, and it allows us to consider what we can do for our claim staff to minimize burnout, presenteeism, and turnover. I want to suggest to you, to finalize, we have had a great deal of trouble balancing people and money in our design schemes. If we add these kinds of things that we learn from this new understanding, better injury management, enlightened system design, and practical individual resilience, we can come up with a different set of answers that might be more advantageous. Thank you. I haven't left a lot of time for questions, but I welcome any of you.
So we do have about 5 minutes for questions. If anyone does have any, can they please use the microphone, introduce themselves, because these sessions are recorded. Does anyone have any for Robert right now? Okay, well, I'll kick it off. Common sense says that you use a carrot or a stick. It does feel like in what you're describing says that both of those might actually be wrong. Is that correct, that the stick of you have to go back to work or the carrot of the benefits are actually all not necessarily working in the way they should be?
Well, I think it's correct to say that they're not working the way that they should be. I think, though, that the conclusion that they ought not to be used as part of the messaging that's given to somebody, as part of the environmental milieu in which people react to the other stressors, is wrong. We can manage the stressors on people in the system, we can manage the system-created disability much better than we do. But we can do it with that kind of carrot and stick messaging as part of it. We should be telling people about the health detriments of worklessness. That's a stick. We should be telling people about how people will react to the loss of control that comes from giving their claim over to other authority figures. That's a stick. But we can also talk about the benefits that they can obtain by doing it in a way that really retains their sense of direction and their sense of control over what their destiny is. Yes,
Robert, thank you for your talk.
If you could just go up to microphone, please.
Oh, very good.
Paul Purs from Four. Robert, very interesting talk, of course, and you very difficult to encapsulate all this in a short talk. One of the issues is really thinking about the people on the front line. So the people of claims managers in various environments, in workers' compensation, life insurance, CTP. What sort of investment needs to be done to help the people see these issues and manage them? And, as you said, unintended consequences of you might say something, and we all do it. We do it as doctors and others. So what sort of investment does an organisation need to be able to change that? And what is a transform? I know it's a very we've got a short time. But what does a transformation program look like?
Look, it's incremental in small steps. You can make a difference merely by, and I've done this with claims staff, you can make a difference merely by presenting this material in a claims-oriented fashion to claims managers so that they understand the person on the other end of the line. So that they understand that when there is an outburst of anger, it's not them, it's not something we ought to be taking personally, it's something that has been inadvertently touched by what's going on. So they can circle back around it and help them move on and change their story. That concept of changing their story turns out to be an incredibly powerful and resonant message for claims managers. So that's sort of the second line. The first, understanding what's going on. Second, understanding that the job of the system is to help people change their script, to move on from what happened to what's going to happen next. That's the second increment. And then there are a number of really, really small, easy changes of verbal habit that can change the nature of the messaging. And a few other things that are very, very powerful, but don't take a lot of investment of money. For instance, things like returning phone calls promptly. Your claims manager may have a portfolio of, what, 80, 100, 125. Your injured worker usually has a portfolio of one. And when they don't get a call returned, the inadvertent message is, your problem isn't very important. Especially when the claims manager said, look, I'll get back to you as soon as I can, but I got all these other files, which are more important than you. All right? So we simply change some of the verbal habits of claims managers, we can make a really good impact. There are other things that can be done, but these are cheap, easy fixes where you can get in, train a staff, and see a difference quickly. And that's the start. But the broader program is also structural. You know, it looks to getting good medical care. It looks to avoiding disputes by giving good information and using good dispute resolution techniques when there are disputes, and so on and so on. But you can start really cheaply and easily.
Okay, I think we're now actually just running to lunch a little bit, about a minute over, so I'll just wrap it up because I'm sure everyone wants to disappear. The obligatory reminder that could everyone please fill out the feedback at some stage. I've presented before. I know that they all really appreciate getting their thoughts on how they could improve, whether our presentation was good or bad. So please fill those out. And so I'd like to just give a final thanks to Robert for what was a very interesting presentation.